You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com. Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Bostet, half woman, half feline, the ancient Egyptian cat god. Cats have held a special place in our hearts and homes ever since. Though there are more cats in the United States than dogs, sadly, because they're experts at hiding their signs of illness, wellness exams for felines are much less common. By the time a pet parent realizes that there's a medical concern, the disease process is often extremely advanced and tragically with fatal consequences. Dr. Joseph Barges, professor of medicine and nutrition at the University of Georgia College of Veterinary Medicine, will break down the health issues that beset cats during their life stages and what can be done to ensure that they'll live long and thrive. We'll be right back after this short break, so grab that kitty of yours, cuddle up, we'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
It's DesignerPetSweaters.com. Hand-knitted designer sweaters for your precious pup or cool cat. Beautiful couture patterns for your pets, including custom-knitted formal wear, casual wear, yachting, and even sports-themed. Many designer pet sweaters include feathered tammy hats, top hats, and a lot of sparkle. Each sweater includes leg loops, front paw sleeves, and leash opening. Visit DesignerPetSweaters.com to order your four-legged fashions today. Your pets will stay warm for the winter and be runway ready. Large or small, we fit them all. DesignerPetSweaters.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Barges, thank you so much for being with us today. You are one of the founding fathers of veterinary medicine with regard to cats in the United States, so I'm very honored to have you on the show today.
I appreciate the invitation to be on the show.
How about we break it down into, number one, how would you describe the various life stages for a cat? So it'd be kitten.
So there are a couple ways. So from a nutritional standpoint, there's four. When you look at the Association of American Feed Control Officials, AFCO, nutrient profiles. And so what those guidelines are, what's known that cats at the four different life stages require to have to be provided adequate nutrition. And the four life stages really can be grouped into two big ones. One is kittens and growth. A second is pregnancy, and the third is lactation. And those three are very similar in their nutrient requirements, and so they're kind of reproduction life stage. And then the fourth life stage is adults. And so I kind of look at it as reproductive life stage and adult life stages. But again, AFCO recognizes four. The problem is an adult cat is, you know, a year, year and a half of age and can be up to 20 or 22, 24 years of age. And there are no guidelines for the nutritional requirements of a two-year-old cat versus a 20-year-old cat, even though we know there are differences in humans.
How about if we break it down to maybe what most of us think of? So you have the kitten, then kind of that toddler, teenager, young adult, right, and then senior in that pregnancy, we'll put in there with adult. Would that work for you?
You know, the American Association of Feline Practitioners breaks it down into kittens and sort of puberty and then young adult, middle-aged, and senior, but then you kind of get to those ones that are sort of like the 100 and 110-year-old people where they're not just senior, they've sort of exceeded what most people normally do. That advanced geriatric, sort of the golden years. And so you could probably break it down even further from that way. But, you know, again, what we don't know are what are the specific nutrient requirements at those adult sub-life stages.
How about we start with kittens? We all can kind of agree with that one. So here you have this little baby kitten. Yes, nutrition is important, but what are some of the other things? Let's talk about vaccines, for instance. That is such a big bugaboo for so many people, talking about vaccines for their own children. They're afraid of them. Do I really need it? We'll recommend, for instance, at my practice, that all kittens be vaccinated for leukemia virus, even though these cats are not going to be going outside or planning to not go outside as they're adults. What's your view on it?
Yeah, I am a believer of certainly vaccinating kittens just as children. Even if they don't go out, you never know. And one argument against vaccinating is, well, we just don't see that much disease anymore. But one of the reasons is we've been vaccinating. So we know it's not eradicated. I mean, it's still present in the United States, and it's easy enough, and at least for kittens, certainly the benefits outweigh the risk.
So there are times.
Leukemia, respiratory diseases, and those common diseases are are worth vaccinating against and protecting against.
There are many times when I will have a kitten come in and they're going to be getting multiple vaccines at one time. And people get extremely concerned that they're going to become ill, over-vaccinated. They're going to have, like their human children, like fevers and malaise. It seems as though most cats do handle it well. From your standpoint, what do you feel of multiple vaccines at a time? Or I know some people say, well, I'll come back next week and get another vaccine. I don't want to do multiples at one time.
Yeah, I don't know that there's good data one way or the other. Certainly there are some that react to it, and the convenience factor of giving them together. And of course, they do that in children to some degree as well. If they tolerate it well, that's worth continuing. But if there are situations where you do it and there is a problem, then separating them certainly makes sense. Or if there's a situation as they become adults that we know we want to separate when the vaccinations occur relative to some other problem, you know, like allergies or whatever, then that's certainly a reasonable approach. I think we typically start out just, again, because they come so conveniently of giving 4, 5, 6-way vaccines every few weeks as kittens, and then finish that up, especially with the rabies vaccine. After that, then, as they become adults, which we'll talk about here shortly, then the decision has to be made of which ones do you keep vaccinating for? Do you vaccinate or do you do vaccine titers? And is there a reason to either give them all together or not give them all together?
You mentioned vaccine titers. Definitely that is an area where some breeders, some people going, especially online, will say, oh, Dr. Google says that you should only do titers because if that titer is high enough, my cat's protected. My feeling is that that titer might be high enough, but I cannot guarantee that it'll be protective. I'd love to know what you feel.
I actually would say that, and with our own pets, we actually have been doing vaccine titers as adults. And it's based on a couple of things. When there's good data, especially out of the University of Wisconsin, about the titers. Now, the problem is, who does the titers and what number you get? And so a lot of laboratories, if you do vaccine titers, you'll just get a greater than number. And it's typically a low number, like greater than 1 to 4 or something like that. The issue with that is you don't know if it's 1 to 4.5 or 1 to 40,000. When we do titers, and when I have done titers not only on patients but my own pets, I want an actual number because I would feel a whole lot better if the titer is 1 to 10,000 than 1 to 10. The second is when vaccine companies manufacture, produce, and evaluate vaccines, they look at the titers relative to the challenge experiment. And so there actually are data to look at what is a titer that is protective. And then the third part of it is, and in talking to veterinarians, because we're sort of trained to think we have to vaccinate. I mean, when I was a student, it was every year. Now we know that many of the routine vaccines can be every 3 years. Even rabies in many places has gone to 3 years. There's data that is coming out that rabies vaccines could be protected for 5 to 7 years, although that's not licensed yet or approved by the government or by the FDA. But what's interesting is when I mentioned this in talk, and somebody mentions, as you did, well, I just don't know if there's a protective. You know, what I usually ask them is, when is the last time you've been boosted for rabies?
And I get my titers done, yes.
Yeah, and you get your titers done. And so what we know from the studies done with rabies titers in people is, above a certain titer, based on exposure, especially in high-risk areas like Africa, that there's a certain titer above which is protective. And again, that information is actually somewhat available. And the titers have been around since the 90s. And Cornell University, University of Wisconsin, by the name of Schultz, they have a lot of data that show that, you know, those titers can be protected. On the converse side, I'll also say that just because you have a titer doesn't mean you are totally protected, because it's not just how good of an immune response you have. It is what mode of infection are you of an agent are you exposed to, and is it a more virulent strain? That's why there are, you get vaccinated for flu, but then there are different strains that occur, and you still end up getting the flu even though you've been vaccinated. The vaccine is for the strains that are known to be present during that period of time.
I think a lot of it depends on what your risk factors are.
Absolutely. If the risk is low, then titers are certainly, I think, worth considering. If the risk is extremely high, then I think titering is okay. But if you're going to do a titer and it's kind of a marginal or slightly, I don't know how better descriptive terminology, good titer, then it may be worth vaccinating again. And the other part of that is if that titer is falling over the course of years and you know at some point it's going to sort of bottom out, you'll need to be reboosted, you might as well do it now while you have that memory response available to you. Mount maybe a better response.
Well, I know that Mark, our producer right now, is listening in, and he has new kittens that he has been fostering, some little outdoor babies, a feral mama, and one of the concerns he has is neutering. So mama, we're not sure if she's pregnant again. He's going to be taking care of that. But the babies, there's been a lot of controversy back and forth with regard to dogs as to the best age with which to neuter them, the effect on protecting them against cancers. What's the newest philosophy on neutering cats? Do it early before they have their first heat cycle. What do you think?
There's two questions in that one question. What is the philosophy and what's my opinion?
Okay.
And there's more opinion than actual fact, at least right now, especially with cats. You're right, there are data coming out in dogs with early, before first heat, spay neuter may increase risk for certain types of cancer. You know, 30 years ago or so, there was a study came out that allowing a female dog to go through heat increased their risk for a certain type of bladder cancer. So, you know, this thing sort of cycles. I don't know of any specific studies sitting here of cats to whether there's an advantage or a potential disadvantage of spaying before first heat or castrating at, you know, at a later age for a male cat. You know, over the course, I mean, the problem becomes pet overpopulation, pet abandonment is still a huge issue. And, you know, the cause of death in those pets are ones that are abandoned is being euthanized because they can't be adopted. And so you get into this trade-off of how do you stem that versus what may be the benefits of allowing them to be go through a reproductive cycle. I think for my personal opinion over the course of 30 years of doing this is I think it's actually a good idea if females go through one heat, males are allowed to get, you know, more reproductively. I mean, yeah, they're allowed to go through puberty, basically. But the real question is, does that, you know, really change risk of disease down the road? And we don't really know that for sure at this point in time. If everybody adopts that, then what does that do for the number of animals that gets, you know, end up in shelters and are become feral and are abandoned and all of that?
A lot of pros and cons. Right now I'm chatting with Dr. Joseph Barges. He's professor of medicine and nutrition at the University of Georgia College of Veterinary Medicine. We'll be right back after a short break. Do want to talk about neutering and the effects on males. I know so many people heard about feline urological syndrome. Does that have an effect? We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
My golden retriever, Sundance, is a lot more playful now. She has more pep and energy.
Tons of energy.
Happy the rescue dog is Happy the healthy dog.
Petey is having fun again. He's got a shiny coat and a good healthy weight.
Molly's been having 4 scoops a day. She pushes her little bowl all the way across the room, emptying every last single crumb. She has slimmed down and gotten this puppy look.
She's got life. She's got energy.
We get asked all the time when we're at shows,
how do you get your dog so healthy and shiny and glossy?
DinoVite.com.
859-428-1000.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
DinoVite is nutrition.
Just feed your dog right.
Due to DinoVite.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000. DinoVite for life.
DinoVite.com.
Hi, I'm Dana Humphrey, the founder of Whitegate PR. We have been specializing in PR and marketing in the pet industry for over 10 years. If you have a pet product or service you would like to promote, give us a call. We can help create awareness for your brand on TV, radio, magazines, newspapers, and blogs. Feel free to reach me directly at 619-414-9307 or learn more on our website at whitegatepr.com or follow us on Facebook.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
So, Dr. Barges, before we had this little short break, was mentioning many times people feel that if they neuter their male cats early, you mentioned a little bit of that before we went on break, that does it have an effect on their male reproductive system and these cats getting urinary blockage, previously known as feline urological syndrome, now feline idiopathic lower urinary tract disease. Too much of a mouthful. You being the specialist, what do you think?
Yeah, this is again, gets to be a little bit tricky because the studies just aren't there yet to know for sure. When we talk about feline lower urinary tract disease, when we use that terminology, we're kind of talking about a group of diseases. And it can include things like stones and urinary tract infections and then this idiopathic bladder inflammatory disease called idiopathic cystitis, or kind of similar to what women develop, which is interstitial cystitis. And the issue with that is, and I actually prefer the term idiopathic cystitis because it's still probably a group of things that we just can't identify what those specific things are. We know that there's a component of stress with it. We know some cats may have a viral infection. We know other cats, we may not find either of those. So when we talk about idiopathic cystitis, the question is, does early spaying and neutering increase their risk? And the answer is we don't totally know that answer. It would make sense, and at least data in dogs suggests, that in some dogs that early castration results in smaller diameter to their outflow tube, the urethra coming from the bladder. And so there could be, if they form stones or something, they could have a higher risk of obstruction or urinary issues. And so for male cats, since male cats are the ones that form plugs, that kind of toothpastey thing that causes obstruction, then that could be a potential problem. But when you look at the epidemiological data, it seems like reproductively intact males and females are less likely to develop idiopathic cystitis. But there are no, that I'm aware of, head-to-head sort of comparisons to know if that's totally true.
One of my favorite words in veterinary medicine is what you've been saying repeatedly, idiopathic. And some people listening to this may not know, what's that word? And idiopathic, if it sounds like idiot, that's exactly how I feel, because we don't know. We don't know what causes it. Knowing that you have such a leaning in nutrition, what is your feeling about nutrition with regard to these idiopathic cystitis issues?
That's a good question, and you're totally correct about idiopathic. When I teach students and give lectures, I mean, the definition of idiopathic is unknown, but what I tell people is idiopathic means we're idiots because we don't know what causes the pathology. And even though, for example, in women, interstitial cystitis sounds like this disease, it is still an idiopathic disease in humans and in women. They don't know all of the reasons for it. So the role of nutrition in cats with idiopathic cystitis is actually, because it is probably more than a single, there's probably more than a single cause to it, and we don't have good ways yet of teasing out all of those potential causes. And once we do that, then hopefully we will come up with ways to diagnose the specific causes and then come up with specific ways to treat that diagnosis, that disease, if it's viral or stress or whatever it may be. But with idiopathic cystitis, there are a couple studies now that show, and one in particular that shows, nutrition has a twofold role in it. One is some cats, primarily male cats, that form these kind of toothpaste plugs will have crystals involved with it. And so we know that we can modify the crystals by changing the diet. And in male cats that form plugs, they typically are young adult to kind of early middle age. The type of crystal that's typically formed is something called struvite, which forms in a more alkaline, a higher pH. And it's composed of magnesium and ammonium and phosphorus. So we know feeding diets that modify that can be beneficial. The other thing that we have learned, at least in one control study, is that feeding a diet that is enriched with omega-3 fatty acids and antioxidants helps decrease the clinical signs in cats that don't form plugs or have crystals, but just have this painful bladder syndrome, that by feeding a diet like that, it does decrease the recurrence of those signs and those flare-ups. There's another study that suggests that feeding a wet food may be more beneficial than a dry food. And the thought is it kind of helps the cat pee more often in a larger volume of more dilute urine, so it kind of flushes out the bladder and the lower urinary tract. So nutrition, at least right now, what we know is has some role in helping these, our patients that have this syndrome, this idiopathic group of diseases, by decreasing inflammation, by maybe keeping things dilute and getting them down to their bladders more frequently. And if they do have crystals, we know we can modify that as well.
So Dr. Barges, client right now, pet owner right now listening to this show going, all right, that's really nice, Dr. Barges, but I need to go to the grocery store or I need to go to the pet store and buy some food right now for my young cat because I want to make sure this cat lives long, thrives. Do I get a raw diet? Do I do a commercial? Does it need to be organic? Does it need to be holistic? What do I look for? What do I feed?
Yeah, there is a whole group of discussion in that one question.
We're getting down to this. We don't have a lot of time, so I know we're going to have to come back and talk about these other life stages.
The answer to that question is because we don't have ways of predicting risk in any individual animal right now, in any individual patient. Is there one specific diet that's best? And the answer is no. For the most part, it's no, because if the risk of developing a certain disease in a cat is very low, then changing the diet to decrease the risk or using a special diet to decrease the risk may or may not be helpful. And that's the problem. So when people ask me, what's the best diet to feed? The answer is there really is no one best diet. Having said that, you are looking for diets that have the most quality control, have the more limited ingredients. For the most part, those are actually therapeutic diets. And the reason is they tend to have more quality control. They tend to have more limited, more defined ingredients. They don't tend to change as much over time. And because they're designed for certain situations, they tend to have more oversight as to their production and distribution and the quality of the ingredients in the food. And talking about raw versus organic, non-organic, all of that is a whole different topic.
All right. I can tell we're going to have another interview. This is definitely true. Okay, let's jump from young adults to adults. What would you feel are the number one health issues for an adult cat? What does an owner need to look out for?
Well, I think in adult cats, what we know that develops over time, at least in adult cats, are the endocrine diseases, the more chronic type of diseases, so diabetes mellitus, hyperthyroidism in older cats, chronic kidney disease in cats, as they get to be 8, 10, 12, 14 years of age, potentially those kind of diseases. Cancer is more a problem with older cats. When you look at sort of these middle-aged cats, the ones that are like 2 to 10, if you want to call them sort of young adult to middle-aged or mature, diseases that sort of show up in that range are typically things like heart disease, certain types of heart disease, inflammatory bowel disease, skin diseases. But there's a lot of overlap. They tend to be, I don't know if this is the right terminology, but they tend to be the less severe, less life-threatening, at least many of them, But as the cat gets older and older, then they become more of the, you know, more life-threatening diseases like cancers and those type of diseases.
But it's still important to treat these. So I am a strong believer of getting that cat in at least once a year for a good wellness exam, even if it looks absolutely healthy. You know, you and I go in for our once a year checkup and you get that well baby stamp that, yes, Dr. Barges, you are still healthy. And we do the happy dance as we walk out. And I think so many times people go, well, you didn't find anything wrong, so why should I bring my pet in? I think that's the whole reason for bringing it in. You don't want to find something. And if you do, you can find it early, treat it early, usually less expensive to treat, and has better outcome.
I agree. I totally agree with that. And you were right at one of your statements in the introduction was there are on a percentage basis, fewer cats that are seen by veterinarians than dogs. And in part, that's because oftentimes there's more than one cat. And then the second is many times they seem healthy and they're eating or they're, you know, and so they just don't bring them in. And cats are very good at hiding issues. And taking them in once they develop issues is sort of past, sometimes, not always, but sometimes it's past the point where you can have a good outcome and certainly oftentimes past the point where you can reverse it back to where they don't have that issue. And you're faced with the situation now of trying to keep them under control and letting them live a good quality of life with a disease process, whatever that may be, if it's diabetes or cancer or whatever. And the other side of that, not to get too long, is I think annual exams are definitely a good idea. And with those annual exams, especially as they become mature animals and just as in people, routine blood work, because you can pick up changes on blood work perhaps earlier than clinical signs develop. So are they starting to develop early renal disease? Do they have evidence of diabetes mellitus or hyperthyroidism? You know, those kind of things, as well as what you find on history and physical examination. And that early intervention not only provides you a means to intervene early, but hopefully, and the goal is to provide not only a longer quantity of life, but a better quality of life, because you're catching things before they're sick. And you're trying to pull them away from the precipice because they present sick. You're catching them early and you can stop them from jumping off the edge. And that's where those annual exams and routine blood work and, you know, that kind of wellness preventative approach is so vital and important.
Dr. Barges, I would love to have you briefly address, I believe, one of the biggest issues in cat health. And that's obesity, where our cats were being kept inside. It's much safer for them, but they're liking what we're feeding them. We're giving them those treats. So many people see a fat cat as being a happy cat. Oh, it likes its food. You know, it's purring. There's nothing wrong with being fat. Your feeling about this little extra chub to make a lot of extra chub these pets are carrying?
Yeah, it's sadly, it's not just an issue with cats or dogs, but in people too. And the biggest hurdle to overcome, the two-part hurdle, is people don't recognize it not only in their dogs or cats, but themselves. And the second is the healthcare providers are reluctant to bring it up and talk about it. And again, it's not just an issue with dogs and cats. It's an issue with people, too. There's one study out of England that obesity was recorded in the medical record in 7% of patients that presented to a veterinary hospital. And yet we know that overweight and obesity occurs in 30 to 50% of dogs and cats. So it's that conversation that needs to happen. A little bit of reserve is not a bad idea, but too much is associated with many problems. And the biggest issue with obesity, honestly, is that obese fat and the more fat you carry, the higher the stress levels. Obesity is a stress situation, and fat tissue is an endocrine organ. So it's producing all these substances that drive that stress even more. And these obesity-related diseases that are seen in people occur in dogs and cats as well. Heart disease, diabetes, intestinal problems, cancer, osteoarthritis. You know, 90% of cats may have some, you know, joint disease. And obesity can be at the core of all of that in many of those situations. So a fat cat, and it's sort of that Garfield, you know, approach to, well, a fat cat's a happy cat, sort of like what it was with children, a fat baby must be a healthy baby because they're fat, is totally incorrect. And the best time to prevent that from occurring, and the best treatment is prevention, the best time for that is during kittenhood. It is harder to get a fat cat to lose weight than it is to keep a kitten during growth phase from becoming fat. And if you can prevent that, then the risk of them becoming obese as they get older goes down dramatically.
Mm. great words of wisdom. Thank you so much. We've been chatting today with Dr. Joseph Barges. He is a professor of medicine and nutrition, as you could well hear, at the University of Georgia College of Veterinary Medicine. If you have other questions that you would like us to address on this show, please drop me a line at thepetdoctor@petliferadio.com. I will gladly answer them as best as possible or find a specialist who can. So thank you so much for listening. Do appreciate it. Please listen again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. So take care. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.